K-Mud Podcast presents.
What is an Indian? During a normal working day, I answered many questions from non-Indians concerning Indians. The questions vary and in some cases poorly stated, but usually add up to one question. What is an Indian? They say he is a person who doesn't work but gets a monthly check from the government. Others say that he is lazy. Still others say he's a man who got a raw deal from the government. Therefore, he deserves what he can get from the government. Also others say that he is a drunkard, will never amount to anything. So therefore, the government should terminate him and let him make his own way in the white man's society. Myself, I do not see an Indian in the same light as any of these people. I see the Indian as a group of people, all different in their ways, but held together by a common bond called culture. I see the Indian as a group who fought for what was rightfully theirs and branded as savages. I see the Indians as a group who fought courageously against overwhelming odds and after giving in and signing a peace treaty, lived to see the treaties broken one by one. I see the Indians as an individual who, when their country was in danger, went to the front voluntarily and gave their last full measure of devotion, not only in the Civil War, but World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, and Vietnam. I see the Indian as a group of people who are proud, and rightfully so, because they possess the secrets of life the white man has never discovered. I see the Indians as a group of people, because even in their broken English, they will tell you how important it is to gain an education in this modern world. I see the Indians as people who, when they cross the culture barrier into the dominant society, become the best in their chosen profession, whether it be law, medicine, politics, trader, athletes, or fighting for freedom. And when I think of the Indian in this light, I think of the question, what is an Indian? My chest suddenly expands, and I think I am an Indian.
Hey, I want you all to know that you're listening to the voice of the free, music and talk that liberate the mind. People-powered radio, KMUD, Garberville at 91.1, KMUE, Eureka, Arcata, 88.1, KLAI, Laytonville, 90.3, 99.5 in Shelter Cove, and on the web, you're listening to us at KMUD.org. My name is Agnes, and this is Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. And I want you to know that support for KMUD comes from Soham Health Garberville Optometry, now serving Southern Humboldt with its mobile optometry unit, offering eye exams, screenings, and treatment for eye-related conditions. Glasses, fittings, and contact lenses are also available, and they're open Tuesday and Thursdays behind the Garberville Pharmacy. More info at sohumhealth.org/optometry or at 707-923-3921. And support for KMUD also has been provided by the Lost Frenchman Wood-Fired Pizza in Redway, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner specials, as well as paninis, salads, juices, and smoothies made with fresh, local, and organic produce. Gluten-free and vegan options are available. The Lost Frenchman's hours are Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. and now open on Saturdays from 1 to 7 p.m. Featuring outdoor dining with a view, 707-923-2030 for takeout or reservations. I opened with Paul Ortega from the Apache Nation, who gave us What is an Indian from his Two Worlds, Three Worlds CD. And he wrote that song, and it came out in 1969. So it's a pretty old song, but it's, you know, when you listen to it, it could have been written yesterday. Well, one of the news stories about indigenous people and the flooding that happened in Alaska made very little news. It happened last week, or towards the end of the week, in the beginning of the week of last week, or the end of the week before. Yesterday, The Guardian had a really good article about it. So it's only now making the news, but it's incredible what happened. So I'm going to share a couple of stories about it, why it happened, I just now got a feed about some money that's going to help them out. But the house rocked as if an earthquake had struck, and suddenly it was floating. Water seeped in through the front door, and waves smashed the big glass window. From the lone dry room where Alexei Stone and his brothers and children gathered, he could look outside and see under the water, like an aquarium. A shed drifted toward them, threatening to shatter the glass, but turned away before it hit. The house came to rest just a few feet away from where it previously stood, after another building blocked its path. But it remains uninhabitable, along with most of the rest of Stone's Alaska native village of Kibnook, following an immense storm surge that flooded coastal parts of western Alaska, left one person dead and two missing, and prompted a huge evacuation effort to airlift more than 1,000 residents to safety. Quote, in our village, we'd say that we're Native strong, we have Native pride, and nothing can break us down. But this is the hardest that we went through, Stone said. Outside the Alaska Airlines Center, an arena in Anchorage, where he and hundreds of others were being sheltered. Quote, everybody's taking care of everybody in there. We're all thankful that we're all alive. The remnants of Typhoon Halong brought record high water to low-lying Alaska Native communities late last weekend and washed away homes, some with people inside. Makeshift shelters were quickly established and swelled to hold about 1,500 people, an extraordinary number in a sparsely populated region where communities are reachable only by air or water this time of year. Many of the evacuees were flown first to Bethel, a regional hub of 6,000 people, but authorities sought to relocate them to shelters there approached capacity. Stone and his family spent several nights sleeping on the floor of the Kipnuk School Library before being flown to Bethel and then on to Anchorage, about 500 miles east of the villages. They arrived strapped into the floor of a huge military transport plane with hundreds of other evacuees. A military plane took 266 evacuees from Bethel to Anchorage, and another 210, said Colonel Christy Brewer of the Alaska National Guard. Another flight transported 96 passengers, according to Alex Pina with the National Guard. More flights were expected over the next 2 days. Anchorage officials were working with the Red Cross to also shelter people at the Egan Center, a convention venue, as well as possibly two recreation centers, Mayor Suzanne LaFrance's office said. The hardest hit communities, Kipnuk and Kiwiligilgog, saw water levels more than 6 feet above the highest normal tide line. Some 121 homes were destroyed in Kipnuk, a village of about 700 people, and in Kiwiligilgog, 36 homes drifted away. Cell phone service has been restored in Kiwiligilgog by Thursday, authorities said, and restrooms were again working at the school there, where about 350 people had sheltered overnight. Damage was also serious in other villages. Water, sewer, and well systems were inoperable in Naspaskak, according to a statement from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Jeremy Siddek, a spokesperson with the State Emergency Management Office, said he did not know how long the evacuation would take and said authorities were looking for additional shelters. The aim is to get people from congregate shelters into hotel rooms or dormitories, he said. The crisis unfolding in southwest Alaska has drawn attention to Trump administration cuts to grants aimed at helping small, mostly indigenous villages prepare for storms or mitigate disaster risks. For example, a $20 million U.S. Environmental Protection Agency grant to Kanuk, which was inundated by floodwaters, was terminated by the Trump administration, a move challenged by environmental groups. The grant was intended to protect the boardwalk residents used to get around the community, as well as 1,400 feet of river from erosion, according to a federal website that tracks government spending. On Wednesday, tribal leaders from across Alaska gathered in Anchorage at the Tribal Unity Gathering to discuss ways to work together to address their community's needs. Ted Gruger and Vic said the flooding did not affect his village, but strong winds affected power lines. Quote, high winds did knock out the power lines and the phone lines, so there was no communication with the village. And due to other regions' power being knocked out, it's taking time before linemen could come in and cut the trees down, he told Indian Country Today. Quote, there was a tree on the power line that caught on fire, so they had to basically shut the whole town down. The lack of electricity has led to people's food supplies potentially being lost. Quote, people are struggling trying to keep their freezers frozen to make sure that they are frozen because that's their winter supply of food. Moose season is just being done with. Maurice McKitty, Athabascan, who lives in Nulato, said the winds and storm surges were unlike anything he'd seen before. Quote, they took our roofs off, flooded our boats, he said to Indian Country Today. Quote, the winds were unusually high. You know, we're entertained 30 miles an hour. We entertained 30 miles an hour winds from time to time, you know, but never 50 and consistent for a whole day and part of a night. While still in Kipnuk, Stone spent his days trying to help out, he said. He would make trips to the airport to pick up water or food that had been sent by other villages and deliver it to the school. He worked to help rebuild the boardwalks on which residents get around, and when he had time, he would return to his battered house, trying to clean up some of the waterlogged clothing and electronics the floodwaters had tossed about. But the damage is extensive. Fuel and stove oil leaked from the tanks, and the odor of petroleum permeates the entire town, he said. And like other villagers in the region, his family lost stores of food intended to help them get through the winter. The refrigerator and the three freezers full of halibut, salmon, moose, and goose. Stone's mother, Julia Stone, is a village police officer in Kipnuk. She was working at the school last weekend when the wind suddenly picked up. People suddenly began arriving at the building, and her on-call police cell phone began ringing with calls from people in need, some reporting that their houses were floating. She tried to reach search and rescue teams and others to determine if they were available boats to help, but the situation was chaos, she said. Her voice broke during an interview Thursday in Anchorage as she thanked those at the school who helped with the response. Quote, "It's a nightmare what we went through, but I thank God we are together," she said. Stone said he evacuated with the clothes on his back. Most of what he owned was soaked and reeked of fuel. The Red Cross provided cots, blankets, and hygiene supplies in Anchorage, he said, and he went out to a thrift store to get more clothes, 2 shirts, a sweater, 2 pairs of pants, and tennis shoes. He is not sure when it might be safe to return to Kipnuk. Quote, "Everybody here that came from Kipnuk, they're pretty strong," Stone said. "If we have to start over, we have to start over." And Alaska House Speaker Bryce Edgman, independent of Dillingham, said the latest storm should be seen as a call to action. Quote, "We knew this is not going to be, unfortunately, the last typhoon," he said in his address Friday at the Alaska Federation of Native Conference. Quote, "We need to be very conscious about living in a state with a changing climate. That is necessary for, quote, a future that doesn't involve waking up in the middle of the night and having water come up from your floor and 100 miles an hour winds and your house floating off somewhere," he said. The Trump administration, however, does not share that perspective. The administration canceled previously awarded grants intended to prevent damages in rural Alaska from disasters that have been exacerbated by climate change, including a $20 million grant for coastal erosion control in Kipnuk, a village of about 700 that was one of the communities hardest hit by Typhoon Halong. The Kipnuk grant was among several awarded during the Biden administration to rural Alaska communities under the Environmental Protection Agency's Community Change Grant Program. The grants were for work like permafrost and shoreline protection, renewable energy development, and permafrost protection. Trump administration officials characterized those projects as unnecessary projects. In a post on social media site X, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin called them, quote, "wasteful DEI and environmental justice grants." EPA officials defended the cut. Quote, "The environmental justice funding canceled by EPA would have not prevented or safeguarded the community from the mass destruction and tragedy caused by such a large and devastating typhoon," Brigitte Hirsch, the agency's press secretary, said by email. Administration cuts to the National Weather Service, part of broader cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, likely had effect on the weather forecast and interfered with preparation for Typhoon Halong's impacts in Alaska. Tomlin said predictions for Halong's path into Alaska made after Trump's administration cuts forced reductions in rural Alaska's weather staff and monitoring were not as accurate as those for Typhoon Merbok in 2022. Atmospheric observations from weather balloons have been cut in Kotzebue, Bethel, St. Paul, and Coal Bay, and technical problems prevented the normal launches in Nome, he said. Quote, "It's almost inconceivable that that lack of upper air observations had no effect." The Government Accounting Office has already identified National Weather Service cuts as a problem. The shortage of meteorologists has created a need for, quote, urgent action to protect aviation safety, said a GAO report that was issued on August 28th. Also axed by the Trump administration was the Federal Emergency Management Agency program aimed at preventing disaster damage. A statement from the agency called Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communication Program, quote, "wasteful and ineffective," even though earlier analysts found it saved $6 in response costs for every $1 in preparation spending. Overall, Trump administration cuts to FEMA have undermined the agency's ability to respond to disasters that are increasingly in frequency, according to a September 2nd GAO report. FEMA has lost about a tenth of its staff, compromising its capabilities, and there are similar concerns about disaster responses at the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In the short term, Alaska Native organizations were waiting this week for FEMA assistance. Resolutions passed by the Association of Village Council Presidents, a group of Yupik tribal governments, and the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the largest tribal health provider for the region, and other groups have requested a presidential disaster declaration and the aid that comes with it. Governor Dunleavy sent a formal request for a presidential declaration, not just for the Yukon-Kuskokwim area, but also for northwestern Alaska, which was lashed days earlier by remnants of the typhoon. And as of Friday, the disaster response was being led by the state, according to a FEMA statement. But opportunities for immediate action beyond evacuations and temporary shelter were limited. Quote, There is very little time to do anything, like even dry stuff out at this point, Thomas said. Winter is nigh. And I just got this in. The Alaska Native Organization and Tribal Governments, in collaboration with the Alaska Community Foundation, the ACF, the regional nonprofits, and community partners, have launched the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund to deliver immediate and long-term support to communities devastated by Typhoon Halong. Nearly 2,000 people have been displaced and evacuated hundreds of miles from home after the massive storm swept through the region. Within days of the storm, Alaskans have raised more than $1 million to help evacuees recover from one of the most destructive natural disasters in the state's recent history. And according to a press release from the Alaska Community Foundation, the fund will address both urgent humanitarian needs and the sustained recovery required to rebuild villages and critical infrastructure. The first round of grants to be distributed within days to fund critical needs, including housing, transportation, food, and emergency supplies. Subsequent phases will support long-term recovery, helping communities rebuild infrastructure and chart a path forward. And quote, through our work and across Alaska, we've learned that the most effective disaster response is locally led, said Megan Casiola, the ACF VP of Programs and Grants, in a press release. Quote, that's why this partnership with Alaska Native and regional organizations is so powerful. The communities are leading the way with statewide support. Yeah, nothing from the federal government. No, not a damn thing.
Doesn't know.
And that was Kashtan, and they're from the Inuit Nation, and that song was We Are Here. Yes, and those Alaska Natives are there. And I was wondering on Saturday as I was watching the millions of people that went out in the street was really quite something. But while they were holding hands and singing Kumbaya, if, you know, they were thinking about all the children dying in Africa because now there's no food because of what Trump did and is doing. All the people around the world that are dying from curable diseases because we stopped funding and giving them the vaccines and the medicine they need. What was in their hearts? And that march was it's a good first step. But a lot more needs to be done. A little more about Indigenous Peoples Day, because I found this there's a couple of stories I have. One of them, and it will include the march that happened in Rapid City. But this is from Shaylin Martos, and she is the new reporter for News from Native California. And and she went to Alcatraz on that morning, and this is what she reported on, and I found the story very interesting. She said, at 4:30 in the morning, and I have to say, I did not go. I have been going for a long time, but the last time I went to the Thanksgiving one, it was so cold. When we got back in our car at about 9:30, it was only 34 degrees in San Francisco. It had been like 28 up on Alcatraz, and the wind blowing, and it was just, you know, I mean, we had the heater in our car on full blast, and we never took our coats off until we got to like Santa Rosa or Windsor way out there. We were going home afterwards. It was just, our bodies were so cold. So it's taking me a while to want to go back there in the morning. So I just I get up and at sunrise, and I pray with the people from my own home. But at 4:30 in the morning, tribal people from across the nation marched to the parade ground on Alcatraz Island to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. Drummers and Native youth holding flags of different nations led the way. It was cold, so people grouped together to stay warm, and the path was illuminated by warm bulbs and phone flashlights. From Raleigh Davis, she said, quote, "We are here to honor truth and history. The International Indian Treaty Council honors those who occupied this island in 1969, who called attention to the injustices Indigenous people are facing. They woke up to the world, to our struggles and our existence, and lit the spark that launched our movement and took us all the way to the United Nations." End of quote. Well, dancers, elders, organizers, and allies celebrated the original 19-month occupation of Alcatraz from 1969 to 1971. They also honored the Indigenous resistors who were imprisoned on Alcatraz, the Hopi and the Modoc people who fought against American occupation. As relatives disembarked from the ferries and made their way to the parade ground, the fire in the middle of the circle was stoked and maintained, and around the circle were chairs for elders and folks with disabilities, and a microphone was situated nearby, the youth holding the flags. As relatives disembarked from the ferries, Morningstar Galley of the Pitt River Nation is the California tribal liaison for the International Indian Treaty Council and the executive director of the Indigenous Peoples Justice. Morningstar, quote, "We still have many of our relatives, our aunties, our uncles, our educators that participated in that occupation that are here on the island this morning. We are here for Indigenous Peoples Day, which is significant in terms of celebrating the resistance, the ongoing resistance of Indigenous peoples." Galley said this year's celebration was complicated by the ongoing government shutdown. Organizers worked to ensure that despite the issues in the federal government, people could still come to honor the sunrise. She thanked the IITC's Rochelle Diver in particular for her work to secure the permits needed to hold the ceremony. Morningstar, quote, "In the past years, when there's been shutdowns, we've not been able to hold the gathering. But in the light of what is happening with this current administration, National Park Service and Alcatraz Cruises, the ferry boat operators understand the importance and significance of today. We are gathered under our First Amendment right, and so we are here to gather today in prayer, in celebration, and recognition of Indigenous peoples here locally and around the world." President Trump says he has plans to reopen Alcatraz as a prison specifically for ICE detainees, but the island is unfit to house any incarcerated people. There's currently a $62 million rehabilitation effort to correct seismic structural deficiencies, and the whole whole areas are fenced off with signs warning danger. From the parade ground facing west, the warden's house and the lighthouse look like ruins, and because of the shutdown, the Department of the Interior was unable to provide comment. Native people began honoring the sunrise at Alcatraz in 1979 when Bill Wapapa organized the first sunrise ceremony west of the Mississippi. Today, the sunrise ceremony also gives organizers the opportunity to inform relatives about their struggles and accomplishments over the past year. Crystal Wapapa, founder of Wapapa's Kitchen, announced the name of her upcoming book, A Feather and a Fork, 125 Intertribal Dishes from an Indigenous Food Warrior. She shared how her journey as an Indigenous chef started from seeing the food insecurity Native people face when she was young. Crystal, quote, "The seed was planted in me pretty much at the age seven, where I seen the absence where it comes into our foods that we didn't have. It is a human right for us to have these foods. When I travel all through the world, all through Turtle Island, I see so many beautiful foods, and so this is one of the reasons why I call myself an Indigenous chef, because I started off in community. I feed community, and it's about community." Relatives were invited to take the mic and share their music, and as elders speak, dancers came through the circle to sweep the ground. Gabriela Flores Romo Mejica is the captain of the UC Davis Kapuli Huasazin Dance Group. She danced with the other Mexica tribal people that honored the sun deity as it rose. Because the dance is a religious practice, community members were asked not to take any photos. Gabriela Romez, quote, "It's prayer and standing in solidarity with all our Indigenous people, because today we're reclaiming the day as Indigenous Peoples Day. We're seeing, I can't begin to pronounce, every day, rise again." And I guess must be their word for the sun. "And basically, he's a testament to our ancestors, just seeing the sun rise again. I just really love being here with different Indigenous people here and learning their stories." The dancers asked all those in attendance to face the sun as it rose and express gratitude. As relatives packed and prepared to take the ferries back to San Francisco, they were encouraged to make tobacco offerings in the fire. Casey Camp Horneck from the Ponca Nation celebrated her first Alcatraz sunrise ceremony with her grandson and her nieces. She came in part to honor her brother Greg Camp, who was an original occupier of Alcatraz Island in 1969. Casey Camp Horneck, quote, "I think that it's always important for Indigenous people to gather, because when we gather, the strength multiplies exponentially. I love resistance to the status quo, particularly when we're living under a right-wing regime that is trying to destroy us." Manny Liros, a Navajo Comanche, and his daughter, Joni Marshall Liros, are members of the All Nation Singers and Dancers based in Oakland. Manny, quote, "I've been in the Bay Area 22 years, and I haven't missed it like since I moved up here. Now I have my own family, so being able to bring my daughters out here and my wife to come and dance and to sing is a blessing." And she asked, "Do you have any tips for anybody who wants to come for the first time?" Joni Marshall lyricist, quote, wear warm clothes, wear lots of warm clothes, and make sure you have food and energy and like water and just like a good mindset, mindset and a good attitude and like, yeah, just be prepared for the coldness. And that was Earl Bullhead, a tobacco offering song. Well, I really wanted to go to the Rapid City. I really thought about flying over there for this big powwow, and then I know these. And then on Monday, there was going to be a boarding school for remembrance, and I just was like, oh, but then. It was only going to be 43 degrees, and I just knew I could not tolerate the cold. So I said a lot of prayers at home. But under crisp autumn winds, a sea of orange moved through the west side of Rapid City on October 13th, Indigenous Peoples Day. Over 270 community members bundled together and walked over 1 mile to the site of the former Rapid City Indian Boarding School amidst 35-degree temperatures. The group made up, that's even colder than what I thought it was going to be. The group made up of Native and non-Native community members gathered together to remember those who never came home. The walkers weaved through the rolling hills leading to the site of the former school and for the first time ever finished the walk at the nearby completed boarding school memorial site, greeted by the over 6 foot tall statue of a Lakota family surrounding a child taken to boarding school. Quote, all of us suffer from generational trauma because of the boarding schools, said Gabrielle Kenny, a high school student from the Rosebud Reservation and the Youth Council who came to participate in the walk. The walk was youth-led with the Youth Council and the Rapid City Student School Board helping pass out names, walking with poster boards of victims' names, and helping organize. And while passing out poster boards with the names of victims, Kenny said the first name in her stack was a young girl from the Rosebud Reservation, her home. Yes, again, that they walked alongside the youth council members during the 25 walk in Rapid City. She goes, I just felt it in my heart. She said, I thought this is probably somebody I'm related to, and they had to go through that. Kenny said her great-grandmother, Mary Sue Redbird, was a boarding school survivor. Redbird had since passed on, but would tell stories of what she went through to her great-grandchildren. Kenny said she thought of Redbird while walking. Quote, "We have elders who are still here and who have passed on that went through the boarding schools. We have younger relatives who are here with us today," she said. Quote, "While walking, we have those thoughts, and you know that their relatives still here with you today." And finishing the walk at the memorial wasn't the only new addition this year. Four children's deaths were uncovered by researchers several months ago, bringing the total number of uncovered deaths to 55, including unidentified children. And shifting through old superintendent records earlier this year, Remembering the Children executive director Amy Sazu uncovered an additional four deaths at the school. This year, those four children, Pearl White, Hattie Blackhorse, Joseph Kills 100, and Cecilia Parted Hair, were added to the list of names read aloud and honored. Quote, "It breaks your heart. It hurts your stomach," says Sazu from the Oglala Lakota Nation about finishing the names. Quote, "This is the hardest work I've ever done, but also the most rewarding." Walkers carried 55 poster boards depicting the names, information about the victims of the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. Conditions at the school, which was one of the several Bureau of Indian Affairs operated schools, were grim and often hazardous. Frequently disobedient children were locked in jail cells, chained together and made to march for hours, starved, beaten, and neglected. Early attendees reported meals consisting of boiled beef and bread day after day. Children's lives were dictated by the bell. They marched to and from from class every day and only spoke English. The school utilized a military schedule and dual educational and working structure, meaning children as young as seven would work half the day operating heavy machinery. Many children were injured while working. Hands and fingers were lost, she said. Quote, "The school closed in 1933, so not even 100 years ago," Sazu said. Quote, "There are still people as late as 2007 that gave interviews as to their experiences there. This isn't that far back in history. It's easy to forget something or think of something that happened in the past and distance yourself from it. But there are people in the community who can't because the memories are in our blood." In the school's 35-year run from 1898 to 1933, approximately 2,089 students attended, according to the records from the National Archives. A majority of students, 88%, were from the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota nations, though some were as far as 700 miles from home. Survivors of boarding school attended the walk, including Leonard Peltier, who was recently released from a nearly 50-year incarceration after being charged with aiding and abetting in the deaths of two FBI agents during the infamous Jumping Bull Ranch 1975 shootout in Oglala, South Dakota. Peltier has maintained he did not shoot the two agents. In January, on the last day of Joe Biden's presidency, Peltier was granted clemency and a commuted sentence, meaning the now 81-year-old American Indian Movement activist could serve the rest of his life on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota, about 20 miles south of the Manitoba border. Peltier himself is a boarding school survivor, having been taken from his home on Turtle Mountain in 1953 and brought to the Wahpeton Indian Boarding School in North Dakota and later the Flandreau Indian Boarding School in South Dakota. Addressing the crowd, Peltier recounted a memory of when he was fleeing from the U.S. government following the shootout and was sheltered by the Kalups Indian Band in British Columbia, which helped hide him. Quote, "I worked on this with the Kalumps. They were fighting very hard to expose the children that had died at the school," Peltier said. Quote, "I love my people. I think we're the greatest nation in the world. I'm going to stay a fighter for you until I die." Peltier walked as much of the mile as he could, despite the injuries he suffered from medical neglect while incarcerated at the Coleman Maximum Security Prison in Florida, where he spent the last portion of his sentence. And, he was allowed, to leave Turtle Mountain to come to the Rapid City, to the big powwow in Rapid City. So he was at the powwow on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But on Monday, he marched and he walked with the boarding school survivors and the people that were supporting them. Also in attendance was the Oglala Sioux Tribe President Frank Starr comes out, Cheyenne River Sioux President Chairman Ryman LeBeau, and Indian Collective President Lissapan Little Elk Garriott. Little Elk Garriott was part of the Department of the Interior team that constructed the 2024 Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative investigative report alongside former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. Quote, in that report, we, as the United States, made it explicitly clear that the purpose of the boarding schools was for stealing children, Little Elk Garriott said. First, they took our buffalo, then they took our land, and then they took our children. If there is to be justice, if there is to be healing, if we are going to move on, not just as Lakota, but as a country, we need to address those three things. The memorial is not yet open to the public, as Suzanne and other Remembering the Children team members are working to secure an emergency management agreement with Rapid City, Pennington County, and the three tribes that are seeking to reclaim the land, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, Oglala Sioux Tribe, and the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. When the memorial and walk are open, it will be the only large-scale boarding school memorial in the United States and will feature a walking path, a statue, murals, and eventually a healing facility and a space for prayer. No, it does not go away. It just does not go away, what was done. And it's the history. It's the history of this colonial country. Okay, I'm going to play a song that it's called My Mother and My Father, and it was written by two brothers for their parents who had been taken to boarding schools. My Mother, My Father.
Ah, 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 ah Woo! This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.